So good morning, Bodhisattvas. And there's a handout. So I'll say a little bit while the handout is going around. So first of all, it's great to be here. As Megan said, a lot of people here that I sat with for many years, and a lot of people that I remember from 2016 when we did this before. And it's wonderful to welcome and meet people that I haven't seen before as well. So it's great to be here. So the last couple of years, I've been actually writing out my Dharma talks for retreats, and I'm going to read again. One thing I'll say about that is it's a pleasure to write things, and I find that I get to explore them and figure them out in a little bit different way and sort of pause over things a little bit. But the other reason that's probably more important is some of you will probably remember from 2016 if you were here. I'm from New York City, so when I get excited about stuff, I speak really fast. I had a deaf student in one of my classes at University of Arizona, and they had two people there signing the lectures, and they told me that at the end of the semester, at the end of every class, their hands really hurt. So I'm hoping not to make your brains hurt. So reading should let me slow down a little bit. So does everybody have the handout? All right. So the other trick is I have to see if I can change pages while holding the mic, but something, maybe you can be my page turner or something, right? So, uh-oh, poetry, but not quite yet, so please sit comfortably. Looks like I always talk about poetry when I come to Colorado, something I do only rarely while wearing a Zen hat in Tucson. But with four teachers giving talks on the same koan, maybe it brings in a slightly different flavor. But not too different. Hockman, commenting on the great koan, "When it's hot, let the heat kill you. When it's cold, let the cold kill you," says, "The student doesn't realize he's being given a method to change his very bones." I have to say, I always find that a little scary, just like Hockman comments a lot of times in the koans that he finds things scary. But the student doesn't realize he's being given a method to change his very bones. "What's the message of the poem?" beginning lit students sometimes ask. Hockman makes clear that in koans, the action is elsewhere, not in a takeaway lesson or moral, but in an intimate transformation. Ditto for poetry. So the literary critic Kenneth Burke points to the incantatory function of the imagery to make ourselves over in the image of the imagery. The kind of world the poem implies in the way it images things, Burke says, make yourself over till you're like that. Become that. Make yourself over in its image. Burke might as well have been reading Hockman. So we can let a poem in the way we let a koan in, and poems like koans are good at making intensely imagined, realized worlds. This morning, I want us to introduce a poem to you and invite you to spend time with it if you don't have anything better to do at some point during the retreat. You can dream with it the way you would with a koan, or let it dream you. One piece of open source advice is to sit with any part of a koan that swims toward you, trusting that the rest will follow along at some point. Same for the poem. Thursday night, I'll talk about some of the ways the poem pulls on me, and then we can talk some more about it together if you like. The poem I'm inviting you to spend time with is William Carlos Williams's The Widow's Lament in Springtime. You have a copy, but you don't need to look at it yet. For me, it interlocks with part of our retreat koan, slowing down and exploring something that happens very fast or goes without saying in our koan. Mujako was widowed at 32. She couldn't get over her grief and became a nun. She came to the teacher, Buko, and asked, "What is Zen?" Buko replied, "The heart of the one who asks is Zen. You can't get it from someone else's words." In her beautiful 2008 talk on the koan, Joan notes about this moment. In Mujaku's question, I hear, "What can Zen do about this grief? How can it help me deal with this unbearable sorrow that I feel?" And her teacher responded not by telling her how she needed to fix things or change things or be different. Her teacher said, "The heart of the one who asks is Zen." So your heart, your grieving heart that feels it can't bear the sorrow, that exactly is Zen. That's where you start, and you don't have to throw yourself away or change yourself or try to become something other than exactly what you are. And if you do that, in fact, and if you do, in fact, become exactly what you are with no separation, that's Zen. So that's all Joan. But then the koan moves very fast, the way Zen can move very fast, and the way the world can, in what feels almost like a jump cut, a montage in a movie or in a dream. At that moment, a deer at a nearby stream gave a cry. The teacher asked, "Where is that deer?" The nun listened. The teacher shouted and asked, "Who's hearing?" At these words, Mujaku had a flash of understanding and left. "Excuse me?" The earnest Zenist, a favorite Hakuin word, at least in English, might have a right to a head scratch or to ask, "I thought we were talking about unbearable grief here, or being right with it, or being exactly what you are. How did a deer get into this?" And by the way, if you don't mind very much explaining, where did her grief go? And grief, be it noted, is nowhere else in the koan explicitly mentioned. Did she snap right out of it so quickly and simply? Jeez, koans. We know the answer is no. Still, some snarky person, not us, of course, might want to send her to Buddha rather than Bukko. Here's part of a traditional story Joan told in retreat a long time ago in the translation I was able to find. Kisa Gotami had an only son, and he died. In her grief, she carried the dead child to all her neighbors, asking them for medicine. And the people said, "She has lost her senses. The boy is dead." At length, Kisa Gotami met a man who replied to her request, "I cannot give you medicine for your child, but I know a physician who can. Go to Shakyamuni, the Buddha." Kisa Gotami repaired to the Buddha and cried, "Lord and Master, give me the medicine that will cure my boy." The Buddha answered, "I want a handful of mustard seed." And when the girl in her joy promised to procure it, the Buddha added, "The mustard seed must be taken from a house where no one has lost a child, husband, parent, or friend." Poor Kisa Gotami now went from house to house, and the people pitied her and said, "Here is mustard seed, take it." But when she asked, "Did a son or daughter or father or mother die in your family?" they answered her, "Alas, the living are few, but the dead are many. Do not remind us of our deepest grief." And there was no house, but some beloved one had died in it. Kisa Gotami had the dead boy buried in the forest. Returning to the Buddha, she took refuge in him and found comfort. In this beautiful, haunting story, grief isn't overcome or outgrown or brought to some satisfactory conclusion. It's assuaged by being passed warm hand to warm hand along the circuit of families in the village, returning finally to Kisa Gotami, who receives it with open hands. It's like a chastening version of that adage Joan likes, borrowed from studies of ceremonial exchange in tribal cultures. The gift has to circulate. In our koan, maybe the deer moment is actually like that, Mujaku herself, her grief included, entering the circuit of forms, of beings. Where is that deer? And where are you? And who hears? In her remarkable new piece, Invisible Ceremonies, read it soon if you haven't read it already, Joan talks explicitly about this moment in the koan in relation to grief. This is Joan again. One day the woman hears the cry of a deer from a nearby stream. "Where is the deer?" the teacher asks. She listens, concentrated, ripe with something. Who is listening? The right thing bursts in her. The deer's cry echoes through the trees and rises simultaneously from her own scarred heart. She is there, cloven hooves wet, and she is here, wondering. and everything is listening to everything. Still, the koan is pretty condensed. Someone whose heart was less open than Mujaku, someone else grieving, or maybe someone taking up this koan, might ask, what does this deer with its call have to do with my grief? The call might even be upsetting. Why does this creature call out, bright and intensely alive, exactly itself? And if it does call to my heart now, where is my grief, and where am I? In Williams's poem, this is the question the speaker, a deeply grieving widow, seems to ask. She registers intensely the circuit of forms. Blossoming trees are her dear moment, and holds it up to measure it against her grief. I think she also asks implicitly, what if my grief, held tightly now, could also be released and pass along the circuit of forms, as in the Buddha's mustard seed story? And are they in some way the same circuit, burgeoning life and grief? So for our purposes, to put it a little baldly, the poem unpacks the deer moment. Here's the poem. This morning, I'll just note a couple things about it after I read it. So now's the time to look. The Widow's Lament in Springtime. Sorrow is my own yard, where the new grass flames as it has flamed often before, but not with the cold fire that closes round me this year. 35 years I lived with my husband. The plum tree is white today with masses of flowers. Masses of flowers load the cherry branches and color some bushes yellow and some red. But the grief in my heart is stronger than they. For though they were my joy formerly, today I notice them and turn away, forgetting. Today my son told me that in the meadows, at the edge of the heavy woods, in the distance, he saw trees of white flowers. I feel that I would like to go there and fall into those flowers and sink into the marsh near them. Here are a couple things in the poem that catch my attention. Sorrow is my own yard. For me, there's something a little odd about this phrase. I know it's a poem, and poems don't usually talk exactly like real people. Still, if you were sitting at a bar, and a stranger sat down next to you and said, "Sorrow is my own yard," what might you think you were hearing? Would it maybe sound a little peculiar? And might you not want to put your finger on what felt peculiar about it? If the phrase is a little odd, what's that oddness revealing? The plum tree and masses of flowers passage. For me, this is an amazing, beautiful part of the poem. One thing that draws my attention is that she's looking at the trees, but masses and load are both registering the feel of something. They are less visual than tactile or kinetic. That's pretty common, apparently. Stuff we see can activate a tactile or kinetic response in us, and it's also part of the subtle, unspectacular synesthesia that emerges often in koan work, a literal sensation registered by one sense, provoking a sensation in another sense. A sensation we might want to call imagined, but maybe not. I think there's something really intimate going on here. For me, it wouldn't be a bad Zen afternoon sitting with this passage, seeing how it might change my very bones a little. By the way, you don't have to stick to the literal letter or even the particular sight-touch relay in the poem. Anything you see or hear around you today, or something that swims up with no obvious reason from the recesses of memory, might be your cherry trees or your deer. or you could just sink into the poem and the flowers, or the koan and the deer cry. The end of the plum tree passage. Today I notice them and turn away forgetting. It's crucial, I think, that notice is in the present tense, as is turn away forgetting. The psychology is tricky here. What are you doing right now? Oh, I'm forgetting the cherry blossoms, or the elephant in the room. Oh, really? What's up with that? Finally, there's the dreamlike passage that ends the poem, where the speaker builds out in her imagination the image of something her son tells her he saw in the woods. Why does it pull on her the way it does? How is it like her own yard, and how unlike it? Does it resolve anything, or might it? Does it allow something to start to heal? And how were the final two lines, two images, related to one another? Quick caveat. One tricky issue in responding to poems, and maybe in Cohen work, is that the characters conjured up aren't real living people we know. They exist only as what we read of them. They don't have actual childhoods full of joys and traumas, the results of which we're seeing in their present, or real futures we need to predict or fret over. So who knows how the speaker, who doesn't exist, really feels, or especially what her clinical prognosis would be. So we have to tread lightly here, and there's plenty of room for divergent responses. Here's mine, at least for now. Given how elaborately hypothetical and conjectural this final passage is, I don't feel impelled to grab the phone and dial 911. I could be wrong, but to me the dream images at the end, in combination, actually move toward healing and assuaging. They imagine falling into the circuit of forms, rather than being suicidal. Anyway, that's another passage I wouldn't mind sitting with, falling under the spell of the incantatory function of the imagery, the invitation to make ourselves over in the image of the imagery. More on Thursday. Maybe the poem will call to you and fetch you sometime between now and then. Thank you.